From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, we dissect the most recent Wisconsin Economic Scorecard poll. Then, Project Milwaukee Power Switch continues with a look at green energy on a residential scale.
Ultimately now, as consumers, homeowners, we're far more aware of what options we have, and we're really understanding the impacts that we have as humans on the environment.
Plus, we visit the Eco-Justice Center in Racine. Choreographer Stephen Koplowitz takes over two iconic Milwaukee locations to explore water through dance.
Site-specific work for me is one that pulls art into the world, into the town square, and really forces the audience and the artists to think about what's out there in the world.
And we learn about the film Before Midnight, the third in a trilogy by director Richard Linklater. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company this morning. There is a new poll that shows decreasing confidence in the state of Wisconsin's economy. The quarterly Wisconsin Economic Scorecard poll is conducted by UW-Milwaukee's Center for Urban Initiatives and Research in conjunction with WUWM and WisBusiness.com. It surveyed 560 Wisconsin residents, asking them about their read of the current economy and the direction they believe the state's economy is moving. The poll also asked about two hot-button political issues, how to deal with a shortfall in the state's transportation fund and confidence in the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Survey manager Joseph Serra spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke, and he offered his opinion on what the most significant trends he believes are represented in the study.
I'm seeing a negative trend in people's opinions, both of the direction of the state and the health of the state economy. And I think that reflects underlying economic realities that the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics is reporting that Wisconsin is near the bottom in terms of private sector job creation. There's evidence of declining wages as well.
I remember when we spoke shortly after the November election, and you mentioned that the generally more favorable disposition people had toward the direction of the state was to be expected around an election. Is the current trend also typical that the further away you get from an election, the more the trend goes downward?
Actually, what usually happens when political issues fade away, opinions among partisans tend to stabilize a little bit and reflect objective conditions instead of political cheerleading. But right now, we're actually seeing a pretty big increase in partisan polarization when it comes to opinions of the economy. And I think that that could be because of bad economic news is getting into the headlines a little bit. So you're seeing Republicans, a big increase in their opinions on the health of the economy. They're saying that things are good, and Democrats are much more likely this quarter to say things are bad.
Was it ideology where the attitudes most diverged, or how did things like personal financial situation play into the picture?
First of all, there hasn't been a big change in evaluations of personal financial situations since last quarter, but people are much more negative across the board when it comes to evaluations of the greater economy. I would say that the biggest predictor of people's opinions right now is definitely their political views.
How did respondents' reads of the current state of the economy affect what their expectations were for the future?
This has been the trend over the last year and a half or so. People who are doing poorly right now, people who think that the economy is doing poorly, they're very likely to say that things are going to stay the same over the next year or get worse. People who are doing well, people who think the economy is doing well, they're very likely to say things are good and that they're going to continue to be good or they're going to get better. So there's real division here in terms of people's views on how things are and how things are going to be.
What did you see in terms of Wisconsinites' personal financial situations? How are spending habits being impacted by the economy? And what are their concerns? How much saving are they able to do?
There is a slight increase since last quarter in the amount that people are spending on non-necessities like entertainment and going out to restaurants. But that being said, every indicator of personal financial problems is up. So people are having a harder time paying their rent or mortgages, paying for utilities, saving for retirement, or paying for retirement.
There were also some specific issues you asked about. We've heard some concerns in the news headlines this week that people have had with highway projects. And you asked about a variety of transportation issues. What were the kinds of things that you asked about and what were you hearing from Wisconsinites in terms of their priorities as far as transportation goes?
Right now, the state is facing a shortfall in the transportation fund. So policymakers are looking at different ways to cover that shortfall. And some ideas that are being kicked around are delays to major road construction projects, the introduction of toll roads on some Wisconsin highways, increases in the gasoline tax and user fees for passenger vehicles, as well as some plans to increase borrowing by doing a bond issue. So we asked Wisconsin residents about this, specifically registered voters, and there is a high degree of opposition to gasoline tax increases, user fee increases, and the imposition of toll roads. People are much more supportive of delaying major road construction projects, specifically the expansion of the I-94 corridor between Milwaukee and Illinois. Although people are generally in opposition to delaying work on the Milwaukee Zoo interchange.
That seems significant because that is especially, you asked what Metro Milwaukee residents and even non-Metro Milwaukee residents generally oppose delaying the zoo interchange expansion.
Yeah, I mean, I think the conventional wisdom has been that there's been a big split in opinion between people who live in the Milwaukee area and outside of it, and that people who don't live in the Milwaukee area wouldn't be as supportive of spending on major transportation projects like this. But there really isn't that big of a division. I mean, there's a fair level of opposition to delaying these projects among everyone in the state, not just Milwaukee residents.
You also asked about funding for the Milwaukee to Chicago Amtrak passenger rail line, and what did you hear there?
People prefer delaying projects like that over having to pay more at the pump or when they're registering their vehicles. But I'd say overall, the opinion is relatively split. I think Wisconsin residents are ambivalent. And they also, there's a large percentage of people who say that they're not sure about how they feel about delaying the Hiawatha line.
Finally, you asked about confidence in the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. This was a story that was all over the headlines a few weeks ago, maybe not as much today, but certainly fresh in people's minds. What did you hear about Wisconsinites' attitudes about the WEDC?
Well, we asked in November, we asked how confident they were in the WEDC's mission of bringing job creation to the state. They initially got into the headlines after the report came out saying that they had lost track of some loans, and a slight majority express confidence in WEDC. So we asked again this quarter, and confidence is way down. There's only about one-third of people in the state express confidence that the WEDC can accomplish this mission, and you know, everybody else is pretty negative about it. You know, there's been some political polarization there, too. So Republicans are actually a little bit more willing to express confidence in the WEDC since November, but Democrats and independents, confidence is way down.
Joe Serra, thanks so much.
Thanks again for having me.
Joe Serra is the survey manager at UW-Milwaukee's Center for Urban Initiatives and Research. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich, and you can read the full results of the latest Wisconsin Economic Scorecard poll at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next on the program, our Project Milwaukee series Power Switch continues with a conversation about green energy on an individual scale. Lake Effect returns with that conversation in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. This week, we've been examining the promise and realities of clean energy in our series, Project Milwaukee Power Switch. Most of what we've talked about in our series has been on a policy or macroeconomic level. But what about green energy as it's been employed on an individual scale? We're all pretty familiar with green design at a residential level, but green energy is also being used by individual homeowners and renters in forms like solar panels or small wind turbines or even your own generator or oil, propane or wood stove. A recent Harvard study looks at the idea of retrofitting older houses to be more energy efficient and some of the contradictions in that practice. Matt Creer is a designer and green certified professional home builder with the Design Group 3 in Glendale. He spoke with Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about green design and what he saw as the takeaway message of that Harvard research.
The U.S. housing stock is ready for renewal. It's been a tough several years with the economic slump, and I think the industry's starting to pull out of its downturn. And the large housing stock is really just waiting to be renewed. There's a lot of foreclosures. Those properties need a lot of rehabilitation. Sustainable home improvements are gaining popularity. And older homeowners, baby boomers, they're retrofitting their home, thinking long term, and trying to accommodate their evolving needs. Aging in place is an example. So I think for all those reasons, we're going to see a lot more work in the remodeling industry.
When I saw the title of that report and it said renew, or we need to renew the housing stock, or the housing stock will be renewed, I thought, oh, well, we're going to rip everything down and start over, or is it what you just said? Is it going to be remodeling?
It's going to be remodeling. I mean, I think there'll be some teardowns, of course, but what we're going to see is that there's, you know, areas for improvement and for retrofitting, that these things can be salvageable, and there are ways to benefit yourself as a homeowner to take advantage of some of these situations and put sensible dollars into the investment that are going to give you a great return, you know, on that investment and help you to be a little more sustainable in your living. So for these long-term purchases, you know, you're going to find that your utility bills are less and that it's starting to pay you back, even in some short-term cases, you know, depending on how much you're willing to explore, you know, for the retrofitting of any green remodeling building or tightening up of your existing structure.
Now, we are in the middle of our Project Milwaukee series on green energy. I'd just like to get your opinion on how green design, which I think a lot of people have a pretty good grasp on what green design is, how do you reconcile green design with green energy?
Green design and green energy, I think, in my terms, would be, you know, one, saving cost, and other, for saving or reusing material is always a good idea, of course, to salvage, reuse, and, you know, make use of what's already there, less effect on the environment, or less impact, I should say. You know, as far as the, you know, the green energy aspect of things, I think we can be more sustainable, and it goes back to savings, number one, putting money back in your pocket, and also your health. I think that there's a, you know, a lot to be gained from being energy efficient and improving your indoor air quality by doing all of those things related to, you know, to green energy. So, again, materials and mechanicals, those things will define, I think, those terms, and there's kind of a gray area in between, but a combination of that can really help make for an excellent home, you know, to live in and breathe in.
Well, for example, green design might be making your house more energy efficient, either a new design or a retrofit, either more insulation, better windows, et cetera. But the house will still be powered by electricity from coal. So is that considered green? Is that one of those gray areas that you just mentioned?
Yeah, exactly. I think the term green has been thrown around, and we almost should be looking for a new term, and sometimes sustainable design is another way of putting it. But, you know, ultimately, I think, you know, green is going to mean that, you know, you're reusing, renewing, and creating a new home that, again, is going to cost you less to operate and improve your indoor air quality and health at the same time.
Well, since we're talking about green energy during this series, I want to get your opinion on things that homeowners can do, some have done, to provide their own energy. And it could be as extreme as having your own generator, which isn't necessarily a green form of energy. But for a long time, we've had the ability for homeowners to put solar panels on their houses. And in some areas, people are actually putting up a kind of a very old-fashioned way of doing it, but they put up a wind generator. So are these things still on people's radar?
A lot of it will have to do with people's long-term investment and commitment into a particular home or property, you know, for its value and also its use. With the technology that's come about since the 70s with solar panels, the technology, you know, definitely has improved. It's made it a little more affordable at its upfront cost. And again, thinking long-term operating costs and less of relying on energy, you know, costs that continue to rise on us, I think that we're definitely going to see more interest on that. And there are some examples, you know, in the neighborhood here where you'll see that people have taken that next step to provide their own energy to be a little more self-sufficient and put money back in their pocket, have it start paying them back eventually. And typically that return on investment is, you know, within 10 years for most people.
Now, I am old enough to remember the 70s and the promise of home solar power, home solar panels. Whatever happened? I mean, there were predictions that, yes, it's expensive to put these on your home, but there was this idea that most new homes anyway would have them because then it would just be incorporated into the lifetime cost of the home. Why did that never happen?
That's a really great question. And being born in the late 70s, I wasn't quite as aware of that till I grew older and learned that it has been around and it wasn't something that came back. You know, it was being introduced now. It had been around. And, you know, I think my guess on the entire situation is that it wasn't as necessary as it is now. It was certainly something that was a clever idea and would be wonderful if it worked. Cost maybe a factor initially, You know, but I think ultimately now, as consumers, homeowners, we're far more aware of what options we have, and we're really understanding the impacts that we have as humans on the environment. And we know much better now that what cigarettes can do, for example. And so we're just a smarter group of people in the world, and I think we're all understanding that there are ways for us to really make a great impact positively on the environment. And again, cost savings. It starts with savings and your health. And it will also give you better value in a home. It's been proven that energy-efficient homes will sell for more. So it's always a great idea for your savings, your health, and your value. And I don't think that'll change anytime soon. That's on everybody's radar.
And what about the idea of wind home generation?
You know, also very popular. And I think where space allows for and where communities are beginning to allow these things to be installed, it's going to get more popular. Again, savings is going to be a huge deal when you have that opportunity in your hands to think long term and live in this space where it's working for you and paying you back. And I think we will see more. That's one that I'd really like to also become a little more involved in the future if the opportunity presents itself.
As a designer, are you aware of any restrictions? Maybe it's a community by community arrangement where some communities probably won't feel too wonderful about you having a windmill in your backyard, especially in urban environments. And I've heard the same thing about solar panels in some cases, or at least even though the licensing requirements are pretty prohibitive. So how do you find that in Milwaukee area anyway? Is the city and suburbs, are they pretty friendly to this kind of non-utility power generation?
I think as it becomes more popular, we're going to see that there's going to be some more strict and solid rules on these things. Right now, it's still, again, one of those situations where, they're being introduced and being allowed, and as it becomes an issue for others, perhaps that the restrictions will grow. I know that solar power right now is really sort of accepted and not frowned upon, even though it visually can create some aesthetics on things. There are those limitations that just haven't been enforced yet. I haven't had any direct involvement on a project recently to know what the limitations are here in the metro area. But, overall, I think that you're going to see those type of limitations increase, but also be worked in so that we can still take advantage of these things.
Well, there's certainly no restrictions on people having satellite dishes.
That's very true and a very good point. So I think that it'd be a tough fight on both sides.
All right. Well, the flip side of that, I guess, besides government regulation and licensing is the utilities. The utilities, do they have anything to gain by people providing their own power, or is their interest too entrenched and they don't see this in a friendly way?
Well, I would suppose that the initial thought would be that they're not seeing that in such a friendly way. But if you decrease the demand, I think that there's going to be some offset in costs as well to them. So there is going to be some benefits for both, as hard as that might be to believe. And I think there will be some cooperation between the two to allow for both of them to benefit and from a savings standpoint.
Something that's more of a green design consideration as opposed to green energy, but it relates to energy in that size. There's been a movement for a while to go back to smaller houses, and by smaller these days, that means 2,100 square feet or 2,500 square feet when it comes to new homes. Do you find the building industry is still a bit lagging in that idea? I mean, I know of someone that wanted to build a 2,500 square foot house, and the builder just would not bring anything in under 4,300 square feet. They couldn't do it. So I'm wondering if that smaller home paradigm is more, I don't know, it's for a select group of people rather than the mainstream home builder.
Yes, I mean, I do think that, again, consumers and homeowners are being very sensible with their needs and, what they're actually going to use. The McMansion term that was always thrown around was bigger is better, and these spaces are just enormous. And I think that fad sort of faded a bit when we start to realize that, we don't need to be such a wasteful society and that you can get by with much less. And when you have the means to do so, that will put you in a more of an elite category in some cases. But again, I think it goes back to, people being sensible with what they actually need and what they want to pay for. And when that comes down to that point, there's a good balance between what you really want and what you need. And when you take those two things into consideration, I think the square footage will come down. There's great creative solutions to give the client what they need when you look at space, space planning, and value.
Is it always a dollars and cents consideration for homeowners? I mean, is it always a you're going to get back what you put into it, or is there a moral consideration in some cases, or just people that want to be more energy independent?
I think there's a small group of people that just want to be more independent. That might be their nature, but the first question I usually get is it worth it? You know, or what can I do? What makes sense to do? A lot of times the renovation itself will be one where I don't need to price myself out of the neighborhood. Does it make sense for me to put that money into this house, you know, or should I move? There's a balance there for the renovation itself, and then also what we can do to be more sustainable and more green practices, both in the renovation and in the existing house. So I really think it does boil down to savings and health and your quality of life. Ultimately, it'll give you value in the end, and I think that, you know, those three things are really going to make for more and more projects coming up. And long-term, as I see it, I think, you know, the way green building and LEED certification for new homes, it's going to eventually be the standard way of the way we build homes. But I think we're far from that, and there's ways to get by without doing that. It's all about understanding what is going to return back to you quicker in the beginning of the process.
All right. Matt Creer, thank you for coming on Lake Effect.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
Matt Creer is a designer and green certified professional home builder with Design Group 3 in Glendale. He spoke with Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about green energy on a residential scale. There's a link to the Harvard Housing Study from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, eco-justice on a small scale that hopes to make a big impact. We'll talk with Sister Janet Weicker about her center next as our Project Milwaukee Power Switch series continues on WUWM. We're back with more of our series, Project Milwaukee Power Switch on Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. This week, WUWM has been examining the possibility that green sources might one day take on a bigger chunk of Wisconsin's electric portfolio. Our series includes a forum taped Monday morning at which a studio audience gathered to hear what experts had to say about the topic. Among those who turned out was Sister Janet Weicker, who has more than a peripheral interest in the topic. The Dominican from Racine runs a facility dedicated to eco-justice. Our environmental reporter Susan Benz visited to learn more about Weicker's work and perspective. As coincidence would have it, the facility is located just south of the Oak Creek coal-burning power plant.
As I roll onto the Eco-Justice Center's gravel drive, the petite Sister Janet Weicker is tending its sizable orchard. She hops aboard a recycled golf cart. It's a gift from a recent high school graduate who's been helping at the center after school for years. Sister Janet, her green eyes flashing, zooms over to my car, saying she's just getting the hang of driving it. She doesn't have much time to explain how this place came to life. A beehive inspector is about to arrive, followed by a team of volunteers.
Shall I start and just tell you how?
Go for it.
Okay. The way it started is we gathered our sisters together, about 100 of them, the first weekend in April in the year 2000. The question we wanted our sisters to talk about was...
Did you notice? Sister Janet hardly takes time to take a breath, and she possesses an incredible capacity to remember exact dates.
Where are we in ministry, or where aren't we in ministry? One of our sisters said, ever since 1862, when our community came to Racine, we've always been about education and justice. And she said, but, you know, right now there's a critical issue, and it's justice for Earth. We are not addressing environmental education in any really concrete, specific way. She says, I'd like our community to do that. So 6 of us out of the 100 gathered around that idea. We ended up talking for 2 years. And at the end of the 2 years, I said, you know, I'm really tired of talking about it. We got to do this.
Perhaps it was sheer determination or Weicker's accumulated skills that prepared her to take on the challenge, starting with growing up on her family's dairy farm and racking up multiple careers, not to mention being at UW-Madison for the first Earth Day. Of course, her religious community needed to buy into the idea, too, so Weicker bolstered her skills by earning an Earth Literacy degree while she combed the area for the perfect site.
In 2004, on the Feast of St. Francis, nonetheless, October 4th...
There's that date thing again.
The community purchased these 15 acres. It had everything we were looking for. Woodland, wetland, pasture land, outbuildings, space for gardening... So we moved in.
Hold everything. How did this ever become available, this spot?
All right.
A miracle of sorts, Weicker says. This parcel fell into their laps after what she thought was to be the Eco Center's home fell through.
Someone gave the asking price in cash. So we lost that property.
Even the resourceful nun was flummoxed. Someone suggested trying a call for help story in the local newspaper.
And on May 2nd, 2004, the headlines in the local section of the paper said, Four Dominican Nuns Almost Homeless.
Actually, it read, Dominican nuns are not quite homeless. No, nevertheless, the religious order's leadership was not amused.
How can you say you're homeless?
But the story got the attention of the owner of this small farm. Weicker paid him a visit that same day.
It had everything we wanted, except the house wasn't big enough. But we thought, well, we could add an addition. Well, the community was upset about that headline in the paper, so it took several months before we actually purchased the place.
Weicker wasn't slowed down too awfully much. 5 months later,
on October 18th, 2004,
she moved in. In order to preach eco-justice, Weicker needed to run a place that hummed in an eco-friendly fashion. Her first order of business was to double the farmhouse's size.
We end up getting all green building material. Oh, and we also said we want to use as much renewable energy in the process as we could. So we have the 55 solar panels on the south side.
Not on the house itself, but the neighboring 1870 vintage tool barn. Back to the house proper.
We have solar panels for hot water on this side. This part of the house, 1912, had no insulation whatsoever. So they put in bio-based foam insulation and EcoShake shingles, which are made out of recycled rubber and plastic.
Later, an eco-classroom and library was erected. Its foundation rests on the farm's original log house. Weicker took a deep breath and wondered how she'd manage the classes single-handedly. That led, circuitously, to the center's final renewable energy investment, the shiny wind turbine we see gleaming beyond a bank of trees.
We were getting school tours and summer camps, programs for adults, and I realized I was the only one working here full-time. I can't keep up with this. So I went to a granting source to see if we could get funding to hire someone. And this group said, no, we don't do that kind of grant, but why don't you have wind as well? So we ended up with this Berge SLX 10K system.
The center produces 90% of its energy on site, and that's not factoring in Weicker's contribution. Springtime brings school groups by the busload to explore here. They cozy up to the resident alpacas, feed the goats, if they can coax them off their newly sodded rooftop, and sometimes hold a freshly laid egg in their hands.
It gets into a sort of squat position, and then out comes an egg. And when it comes out, it's all wet, and it has this thing called a bloom on it. And you pick this egg up, and you can see it's shiny and moist and warm, and we pass it around. That is an awesome experience for kids. They'll remember where eggs come from and what makes chickens happy. And, you know, there's some intangible things.
Weicker says weeks of planning goes into preparing for summer camp season when groups of 25 children come for a week at a time.
We're going to take time every single day to do a wonder and awe piece with the kids. They're going to go away someplace and then observe something real close up. Just even looking at that leaf of this hazelnut tree. Look at that pattern there. The edges, the veins, the rhythm, the harmony that's there. So we're going to be doing that, and the kids will get a chance to journal and draw. Oh, it's one of our gardeners.
Strolling the center's gardens, it's energy-efficient everything, dodging the paths of roosters and geese. It's easy to forget just a few miles north stands an imposing coal-burning power plant. Weicker describes its proximity as a sheer coincidence, yet admits its presence might contribute to the sense of urgency that underpins her work.
We can do our little bits. That's not going to be enough. you know, if we have enough people to tip the balance being concerned about it, we can turn this thing around. But as I say, our window is small. Our window is small.
Her window of time with me has closed. A group of high school volunteers from LaGrange, Illinois, just rolled in to help with some chores. Weicker has her work cut out for her. The teens have never stepped foot on a farm, let alone performed a chore. So she'll warm them up with a tour. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Sister Janet Weicker is a Racine-based Dominican nun. She directs the Eco-Justice Center in rural Racine County and attended WUWM's Project Milwaukee Power Switch Forum earlier this week at Discovery World. Environmental reporter Susan Benz visited Weicker at the center. Coming up tomorrow on the show, our Project Milwaukee Power Switch series concludes with that forum on the future of clean energy in Wisconsin. It was recorded in front of a live studio audience at Discovery World. If you missed any of the series, either on Lake Effect or from the news department, you can find the entire series on our website, wuwm.com/Project Milwaukee. Coming up next, the Peck School of the Arts concludes its 50th anniversary celebration with 3 days of site-specific dances. We'll learn more about them when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Stay tuned. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie Noor. Thanks for joining us. The Peck School of the Arts has been celebrating 50 years of art making all year, and the concluding event begins tonight. Internationally known and award-winning choreographer and director Stephen Koplowitz is premiering 2 large-scaled world premiere dances here, both site-specific performance works that are informed and inspired by the architecture and ecology of water. Koplowitz worked closely with UWM dance professor Luc Vanier, composer Tim Russell, more than 24 dancers, and members of the Bel Canto Chorus to explore the North Point Water Tower and the Cudahy Gardens at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Koplowitz and Vanier joined me in the studio in between rehearsals last week, and Koplowitz said that his childhood had a great influence on the artist he became.
I think the fact that I grew up truly multicultural in the sense that I was born in Washington and then shipped off to France for 6 years and then back to Washington and back to France and then back to Washington and then to Brazil. And then, so I was constantly being aware of the fact that the world was bigger than just my neighborhood as a small child. And also being forced to really, I know this sounds funny, but I think had I not had the childhood I had, I would have been more shy than I am. But I was forced not to be shy because I had to make friends a lot. So I think all that has influenced the fact that my art is really only interested in humanity, really. I say that it's interested in 2 things. It's interested in the body, in the human form, and it's also interested in how we as humans interact with the world or society. And so all the art I've made as a choreographer and a director has been based on investigating some aspect of human behavior or humanity, I guess. And, you know, site-specific work for me is one that pulls art into the world, into the town square, and really forces the audience and the artists to think about what's out there in the world.
Do we get something different in that kind of art than we would, say, seeing one of your dances in a theater?
Yes. Well, because there are so many other levels of things going on, and the audience has to work. Has to participate more. Experiencing a site-specific work is usually not as passive as going into the theater, sitting in your seat, and letting it wash over you in essence. It's not that your brain stops working when you're in the theater, of course, and you're participating in that way. But usually, you know, you're probably not sitting in a seat. You're probably having to walk, to promenade perhaps for some work, like the work that we're doing at the Milwaukee Art Museum, the audience will have to move 3 times. It's a work in 3 sections. And so they'll have to participate in that way. And there's more stimuli going on. You're taking in the environment. Then you have to focus on how the environment is being engaged. You know, there's more sound stimuli going on. You also are adapting to a place that either is brand new to you or is well known to you, but now you're reorienting yourself. And
you're talking as a choreographer in that sense, or
no, as an audience.
Okay.
I'm talking as an audience. Now, good art in the theater makes you reorient yourself just by sitting in your seat. You know, it makes you completely rethink or recontextualize whatever is life or whatever. Or, you know, that's the power and the beauty of art, that it has the power to transform. You can say that the artistic experience ultimately for the audience when it's working has very similar characteristics no matter what art form you're looking at. I truly believe that. But I think that as an audience member, there is a certain – I guess I'm asking a little bit more of the audience in terms of, you know, their participation.
You know? Well, you talk about it. I think it's in your artist statement. You talk about how art can be inclusive but yet still – not be unfocused, still have the power of your vision as the choreographer, as the artist. And it just sounds like you're gathering people in for that inclusivity and kind of requiring that, as you say, that higher level of participation.
Yeah, I believe – I mean I have no problem telling people that my work is highly – is very accessible. But I don't believe that accessible art – needs not to have a certain level of complexity or craft or ask the audience or demand something of the audience in terms of their attention or whatever. But I do pride myself on making work that allows people a way in. And I think that's important on some level.
How does work like this be both collaborative and yet ultimately your expression too?
I liken a lot of the work that I do as a side artist. And I think as an artist, I tend to work this way. I look at the model of film directing where you are collaborating with a composer and scene designer or a costume designer, a cinematographer. But everyone's working towards one vision. That doesn't mean that there isn't dialogue and collaboration. And I mean, with Luke, you know, we're both looking at the side. I might come up with an idea, a concept of a structure, but then it's how do you fill that structure? What decisions are being made? And that's all happening through conversation and dialogue and collaboration. In the case of the Water Tower with Luke, in that sense.
Yeah, yeah. And Luke is perfect time to bring you in on this, because what is your role in this entire collaboration?
Well, I've known Steve for years. Met Steve at the University of Illinois. We have a friend in common, worked with Steve before, Sarah Hook. And I just begged Steve to work with him. Everything that he just talked about in terms of navigating sort of a sense of accessibility with a high quality is something that always challenges me. So I was the one to suggest that Steve come. I think Milwaukee is a great place for what Steve is doing. And basically, this was going to be it. That was my collaborative side to this. And then he suggested that I work on the projections for the Water Tower. My interest in technology has always been the same as his interest in site-specific work, where I like to use technology to allow us to connect to work differently, not to sort of flashing up the work, but to more sort of reveal a side of the work, amplify a subtle body connection, use motion capture in a way that sort of sensitizes the space for the dancer. So the technology in general becomes that type of stuff for me. So I'm not a visual artist by trade, but I am a technologist. I'm someone that loves to see how things can be modified and reimagined and transformed through the use of technology.
One of the things I love about using dance in this way is, of course, you're starting with that fundamental thing, the human body, moving through space. And then you add all of these other things. And it seems to me that dance lends itself to this kind of exploration in a way that other arts don't.
Luke's being very modest. He is a visual artist. And you can't be a choreographer without being a visual artist, but he more so than others, because he's constantly imagining both how the body is interacting with these visuals that he creates through technology. But anyway, I started my career in music, actually. I have a degree in composition, and in high school I started writing music for dance. And so the idea that music could be married to dance happened very early in my career. But then I realized that if I really wanted to have a dialogue with all the arts, that I'd be far more efficient and exciting to do it as a dancer, as a choreographer. And so I went from music into dance because of that. And specifically contemporary dance, which I think naturally requires a deeper conversation, a deeper collaborative conversation with the other arts than other art forms. And then when you look at site work, site art, you know, there's a longer history of site-specific visual art. But there it's really the matter of repurposing or creating objects that are placed or inspired by a specific location. So invariably, we're talking about something that's inert. Here, because the body is the stuff that the work is being made out of, it automatically is going to comment on how we as people think about, behave around, or even how we compare to certain places by placing bodies specifically in these spaces, and then placing them and giving them specific behaviors. This is something that is living and breathing, and so that has a different kind of power.
And it's ephemeral.
And it's ephemeral, yes it is.
In this case, more ephemeral than others. I learned this from Steve. Site-specific as opposed to site-adaptive. So site-specific means that the work lives with that choreography, that space, that area, that, you know, that moment. It's very, very ephemeral.
Yeah, it can't be moved to another place. So what I'm doing for the water tower and for the Milwaukee Art Museum, for those spaces, I'm not going to go and do it at some other city or location. All the work I'm making can only exist in those two places.
Why those two places? What was it about those two places that made you say, this is where I want to do this?
You know, I was lucky. I mean, I was able to come to Milwaukee two times, maybe three times, to do research about the city. And the first time was a year ago in June. Luke and the Department of Dance and Simone Ferro said, you know, come to Milwaukee and let's just see what sites interest you. And I had been working for the past several years on a series of site works that were all inspired by water. And I'd done this in Los Angeles, and then I'd done it in Plymouth, England in 2008 and 2009. And then 2012, I did another large-scale site work around water in Houston, Texas. But I came here thinking I'm going to find some interesting sites, whatever inspires me and it also inspires them. And it was almost instantaneous. I mean, you come to Milwaukee and you can't – I mean, water is so ingrained in the history of this city and in the future of this city. And it's being embraced in a way that I think that few other cities are really embracing it, both from a business point of view and from a tourist, you know, and cultural point of view. It just seemed like a natural thing to continue this series. And so we started to really collect many, many sites that dealt with water, which there are many. And then we had to look, obviously, at the budget and the amount of time that we had allocated for this project. And in the end, it came down to these two sites. And I believe, you know, if you were going to start a series of water-related sites in Milwaukee, I think these are two good places to start. You've got two of the major icons of Milwaukee. You have the Water Tower, which speaks to the past, and then you have the Milwaukee Art Museum, which speaks to the present and the future.
Well, Steve and Luke, thank you so much for coming in and talking
you.
With me. Choreographer and director Stephen Koplowitz and UWM dance professor Luke Vanier spoke with us about Summer Dances, the concluding event of the Peck School of the Arts' 50th anniversary season. It begins tonight at the North Point Water Tower. There's more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break and then learn about the third film in a trilogy by director Richard Linklater. Stay tuned. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Before Midnight is the third film in a trilogy by director Richard Linklater. It depicts the culmination of a relationship between Jesse and Celine, also known as Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. The tone of the movie stands in contrast to its idyllic Greek setting. Lake Effect film contributor Dave Lurson spoke with Dan Harmon and offered his thoughts on the latest installment in the series.
Jesse and Celine have been the favorite heartthrobs of the smart set since their 1994 youthful romp in Vienna, Before Sunrise. They returned in 2004 for a romantic day in Paris in Before Sunset. Wrapping this trilogy in Greece with Before Midnight, director Richard Linklater brings Jesse, played by Ethan Hawke, and Celine, by Julie Delpy, to a midlife crisis crossroads.
So I have a feeling we're going to disagree about this movie because I thought it was too long. And frankly, it's just what makes it more than just another movie about people's marital problems?
Well, several things, I think. It certainly is not the only trilogy ever filmed. It's not the only movie that takes place within one day that's ever been filmed. But here you have the development of two people over an 18-year period of time with three films widely separated. And you can get a sense, almost as if in real time, of the development of the characters. I think that that's interesting. I think that the dialogue in Before Midnight is wonderful because it seems very natural, intelligent, smart, yet unaffected. It gives off the appearance of being unscripted, even though there may have been some spontaneous moments in there, but they were following a plan. It wasn't just throw the two of them out there and let the cameras roll.
So you didn't think that it was a little self-indulgent? Maybe the characters were a little self-indulgent.
Well, yes. The characters are a little bit self-indulgent, both of them, but I think that that would be the point. I mean, it would be like saying, you know, a movie with an evil character is an evil movie because there's an evil character in there, right?
I guess my biggest complaint, and I do have some positive things to say about the movie, but my largest complaint is I didn't really understand the point of or what we were supposed to get out of their problems they were having with each other. I was waiting for a larger point to develop during the movie, and to me, it never really did.
Well, people can grow apart. It's a particular problem, maybe a more acute problem in our society today than it would have been 50 years ago and before that time. People have more time. People have more options. People have more things they can do and be interested in, become fascinated with. And that's part of the problem with this couple. They're beginning to grow apart. Then there's the other thing, which I think has been eternal, that there are little disagreements, little cracks in relationships that people paper over, that you're in denial over, you don't want to address it, it doesn't seem really important enough to bring up. But if something that you could call a crisis or a crossroads moment occurs, many of these things begin to come to the surface, and all of a sudden, here you have, what about that time when you, you know, left me, you know, stranded at the restaurant or whatever the complaint is, or you're not very good in bed. You know, that was one of the things in this movie that Ethan Hawke character apparently thinks more of himself in that way than the Julie Delpy character does. Not that it bothered her for all these years, but now that they're having an argument, why not bring that up? I think that's very realistic.
And that would be my backhanded compliment, if you will, is that the arguing seemed very real. It seemed like a natural way that people argue when they're in couples. So I'm wondering if how much of that was ad lib and how much of it was completely scripted.
I don't know. I think it's a mixture of the two. Richard Linklater has worked certainly with those two in these three movies. He's worked with Ethan Hawke in other situations, and I think that there is a very good rapport between director and cast here that allows for the possibility of working from a script but creatively improvising within that.
Okay, now for some positive comments, for me anyway. I thought some movies are, I think, made by their scenery, and I thought they really took advantage of the setting and not just that it was there, because you can set a movie somewhere and make it look terrible, but they set it in Greece, and it was a beautiful movie to watch.
Well, it's a beautiful movie to watch. All three of these movies were set in beautiful places. The Greek setting is interesting because there's something going on just below the surface here. This movie has to do with the influence of the past on the present in the relationship with these people, but they are surrounded by a landscape in which the past influences the present. There are ruins from one era or another. There's a sense of tradition encountering the modern world. This provides, I think, a very interesting background for the problems these two characters are facing.
So like the black and white of the beautiful setting, but yet there are some problems of Bruin, so it's not quite what you're used to seeing when you see vacation movies in Greece.
Well, Trouble in Paradise, I mean, that's an age-old theme, I guess, as well. And people plan these beautiful vacations. Tuscany was big a few years ago. Maybe Greece will replace it now. And, well, fine, you know, you're going to a beautiful place. You're getting away from it all, but really you're not. You are carrying yourself with you. the problems that you have with whatever partner you may be traveling with. If you have problems, if they as individuals have problems, you're not escaping them. You're not leaving them behind like a suitcase that you didn't pack and bring with you. And that, I think, is another theme of this film.
Something else I really actually did like was just some of the filmmaking aspects of it. One of the first scenes is a very long shot of them in the car. And I was actually watching to see how much of that is edited away and how much of it was truly a super long, multi-minute scene where the actors had to stay in character the entire time. There's no cutaways when they're driving back from the airport in the beginning.
It's a triumph of good acting. But this movie, though, it's a very conversational movie. I mean, you could say that it's a series of long conversations. But Linklater is also a very visual director, the way he keeps the story moving along. A boring director would have bogged down with this material or just been, two people talking or a group of people talking in some cases. But visually, and it's very subtle, Linklater makes very good use of the whole idea that movies are actually moving.
Just a random thought I had while watching it. I thought it's very much like a Woody Allen movie, and it's pacing and the focus on relationships and including arguing. So I thought, does he have any kind of homage to Woody Allen or just the same genre?
You can't really escape thinking a little bit about Woody Allen with this film. Richard Linklater and, in fact, Ethan Hawke, too, are very characteristic of something we don't talk about as much. Generation X, now we're on to the millennials, I guess, talk about Gen X as much, but they were very characteristic in their early films. Linklater's slacker and dazed and confused, but he also refuses to be easily pigeonholed as a director. When you begin to look at his resume, he's done a rather incredible number of different kinds of films. And I think that of all the people who are touted as the great Generation X voices of the 1990s and so on, he may be the one that in years to come people will look back on as being the great talent to emerge from film during that time.
Well, I guess overall you liked this movie. Do you have anything that you thought could have been done better?
Not particularly better, but I would want to make this point that you do not need to have seen the other two films to make sense of Before Midnight. Naturally, if you have, you can think back and connect this thing with that thing. But again, the proficiency of Richard Linklater as a director and co-writer of this project means that you can have missed the first two-thirds of the trilogy and just pick it up right away. It doesn't require any advanced knowledge of who the characters are.
Was this a film that showed well at a film festival? I'm not sure if this is one that really got its notoriety from a major film festival.
Well, it worked the film festival circuit a little bit, I believe. It works its way from the big coastal markets into Milwaukee and from there hopefully into other places. So it's following the usual pathway for interesting, more important, significant, independent movies.
Okay, thanks for coming in, Dave.
Thank you.
Lake Effect contributor Dave Lurson is the arts and entertainment editor at the Shepherd Express Weekly and the author of its I Hate Hollywood blog. He spoke with Dan Harmon. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.